Welcome to Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 2nd, 2017, and today we will be going back into public hearing on SB 5535, Department of Revenue. Now we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday, and we'll begin with the Business Division, followed by Tax Gap. And we have on leadoff batter is Mr. Derek Gasparini. And John, staff, is there anything that we need to know before we get started here?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. No, I think the department is here and they'll do the best they can. They're still going to be talking about compliance for today, and then a little bit of fraud detection and audit selection.
Mr. Chairman, before we move into this new subject area, I had a couple of carryover questions from yesterday. Is it possible to have the director come up for a few minutes?
Yes. Director, would you mind?
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs and Representative Gomberg.
For the record, your name, please.
My name is Nia Ray, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I apologize.
Thank you, Ms. Ray, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesy. Ms. Ray, we talked yesterday about vacant positions, and one of the things that we uncovered was the fact that there were about 100 vacancies within the department right now. I wanted to start by simply asking, what happened to the money that we allocated for those positions that are now vacant?
Chair Manning, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand. You mean the 31 for collections, or do you mean the entire 100?
Mr. Chairman, Director, I'm talking about the entire 100, the 31 for collections, and I understand that these were decisions made by your predecessor, but when we allocated in the neighborhood of $10 million to fill 100 positions and we find out they're vacant, my first question is, was the money spent for something else, or is it still available?
Representative, that question would probably be best answered by someone other than myself. I'm sorry I don't have that answer for you today.
I see somebody's got your back, Director.
Yes, I think my budget director is here, and she may be able to answer for us.
Okay. For the record, please state your name.
I will. Thank you. Co-chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Waite. I'm the Administrative Services Division Administrator, and I oversee the budget section within that division. So one of the things that you will see when we close out the biennium, there's approximately $6 million that we have not spent to date. We have promised the governor's office and the Department of Administrative Services that we will for sure have about $4.5 million that we're reverting back. That is all related to personal services savings. Some of the remainder of those personal services costs that equal about the $10 million have gone to either like Joanne Martin, the PTAC administrator, talked about kind of double fills our TWAs. So while those positions are vacant, we have brought in people that are working in a capacity behind those vacant positions. So they are used for personal services costs.
Well, we're going to have the same one. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what I would like to ask is if you could get some details to the professional staff on what positions are vacant, what positions were backfilled someplace else, and what happened to the dollars. I think we'd appreciate a little more detail than simply the fact that we've got $4 million left over and we double-filled some other positions someplace else.
Okay. Senator?
I'm absolutely there, and in fact, I'm probably crabbier. We appropriated money based on certain representations that the agency made, and it appears that those promises haven't been kept. I have to be honest, I am stunned at how many vacancies you have, and Representative Gomberg has been beating the drum about uncollected revenue. We're about to transfer a lot of that collection, or if assuming the policy bills pass, a lot of that work to you. And I sort of feel like we got hoodwinked a little bit. Big promises about give us more people and we'll get that revenue collected. Well, now you're going to revert it for other purposes and personnel savings, and you mixed it and matched it behind the scenes, and I don't know whether or not that happened with legislative okie-dokie, but we appropriated it for a purpose. And it appears, unless you can tell us otherwise, either now or in writing, it appears that we kept our end of the deal. I wonder about the agency.
So, co-chair, members of the committee, Representative Gomberg, Senator Johnson, to respond to your questions, yes, we can absolutely get that detail to you. One of the things that we did do in December, we were prepared to hire several of our positions, but based on the 10% reduction exercise that we submitted with our agency request budget, and also the reductions that were identified in the governor's budget, we opted not to proceed with those hiring practices. So that is part of it, and we can explain that further.
Follow-up. Did it occur to you to check with LFO or to ask to make an appearance before any of the meetings of the legislature when we weren't here in full-time session?
Co-chair, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, no, we did not come forward to LFO staff or consider coming here. That was an agency decision that we made on our own.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, I really feel at this point as though you've broken faith with the legislature. Why would you feel empowered to make a decision when money was appropriated for one purpose and used for something else, that there was not a clarion call for disclosure?
And co-chair and members of the committee, Senator Johnson, I would have to get back to you on that as far as what the leadership decisions were for that.
Okay. And as long as we're at 100, I very much want that. And what I don't want is blame the dead guy. I am so tired of changes of administration in agencies, and we all point the finger at the person that's no longer there. So just be forewarned that that isn't going to work for me. That your former director was not the only person in the room when that decision was made. So that's just a marker laid down for you. So as long as we're at this point, I also want to jump up and talk a little bit about audits. I think you've undergone three audits.
Are you, co-chair, Senator Johnson, are you referring to the financial audits?
Yes, and okay. Maybe you're the right person to talk to about
correct.
That.
Correct, yes.
Okay. What were the findings of those audits? Whose audits were they, and what were the findings?
So we have done some internal audits of our travel process and expenditure reimbursement, but really the main audits that we have done are through the Secretary of State. The audit findings have been very consistent over the last several years. One of them is in relation to not recording accruals or financial transactions correctly.
Let me interrupt you. Would that be considered a material issue in a management letter to you?
So the ones that I'm a co-chair, Senator Johnson, members of the committee, these are all, they have all, the ones I'm going to talk to are all material.
Okay.
They're or identified as significant deficiencies. So we had the not recording our accruals appropriately or recording all of our transactions. We also had ongoing year after year not completing all of our cash reconciliations timely. We do make sure that all of our cash reconciliations, the larger accounts, are done on a monthly basis and are reviewed and gone through the appropriate accounting best practice principles. There are some very small cash reconciliations that I plan on talking about when we do our finance management overview presentation on Monday that I can go into more detail about. The other deficiency that was identified was specific to knowledge skills of our accounting staff. And as I mentioned during round one, there was I had explained that we've had significant amount of turnover in our accounting section, and we really only have three accountants at this time, senior level accountants, and they're all new.
Well, why? I mean, you are our big deal fiscal agency. You've had material findings. You've only got three accountants. Why have you not filled those pivotal spots that were the subject of significant findings in an audit?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, we really, in our accounting section, we have one vacancy at this time, and that position just became vacant within the last year. That, and that position is being held vacant because when the CSR project is completed, we have a person that is coming back to the accounting team.
Okay, I'm going to stop grinding on this in a second, but you've got bad audits, and you say they're consistent over the years. Where is the management plan to fix that? There's been so much focus on your new program that I think we've lost track of the fact that the agency has huge problems. You've got significant audit findings. I don't know if there's a plan to deal with those, and I certainly would expect to see it in writing to the professional staff. I ran a state agency for a brief period of time, and if I'd had one bad audit finding, I'd have been on it immediately to fix it. So these are consistent failures. You're holding open a significant position. I don't know where the plan is to fix this, and I'm just unwilling to accept turnover in accounting. Why haven't you come and asked for assistance, asked for legislative permission to hire other people to deal with this?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, so I do have a plan, and I plan on speaking to that Monday during the financial management. I am happy to submit the plan to the LFO staff in writing.
I want it before Monday. I don't want a death by PowerPoint. I think the committee deserves to see that plan and to see it ahead of time so that we can be prepared to ask knowledgeable questions.
Okay.
Representative Gomber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Johnson, actually, over the last 20 years, there have been six audits on the question of delinquent debt, although in all fairness, it's not only aimed at the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, yesterday when I asked a question about all the debt coming from other agencies through Senate Bill 89, what you would need to accomplish that, and the answer was more resources. I want to start by making it very clear that I will support more resources for the Department of Revenue if we're actually hiring people to do that collection work. What I can't support is allocating more money to hold vacancies open. My question for you now is, these vacancies, was this a cognitive planned decision not to fill these slots? Were we just simply not able to find the people with the qualifications to get the job done? What's going on that we've got so many vacancies across the breadth of the agency?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Gomberg, I can speak for the 6 or 7 months that I've been here. First of all, admittedly, I did not make filling vacancies my first priority upon assuming the role as director. And I think when most people assume a new role, they don't go out and hire. There's a period of assessment. You need to figure out what's going on. And you know, truthfully, some individuals may claim that they need resources that they simply don't need because you're the new person. So that level of assessment did have to be done. Second of all, when the vacancy issue was presented to me, it was presented as a situation born out of a certain level of necessity because there were so many budgetary concerns surrounding reductions, cuts. We had a governor's budget that had a certain level of restriction. And so we were uncertain as to whether it made good financial sense to really hire a group of individuals, given the fact that we didn't know if we'd be able to support them throughout the remaining biennium.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we talk about good financial sense. The numbers I saw yesterday is that we hired 30 collection agents at a cost of about $3 million and generated about $36 million above the goal. I mean, certainly you've demonstrated that you've got the ability to do the job when you hire the people to do the job with. I'm not sure what kind of accountability you're looking at, but in my business, if I can spend $3 million to collect $36 million, it's a good investment.
Chair Manning, members of the committee, Representative Gomberg, that is correct in that instance, that we did hire a certain amount of people that did provide an appreciable return. However, all the vacancies would not be channeled in the collection area. Those vacancies would be dispersed throughout the agency. And at a certain level, there is a diminished return. So you have to be certain when you hire individuals that you will receive and achieve the type of return that you expect from the investment.
I think you're absolutely right, Director. There is a diminishing return. I'll be happy with a 200% or 300% return on my investment. And, of course, the context here is that we've got a huge gaping budget deficit. We're trying to fund schools. We're trying to fund senior programs. We're trying to take care of Oregonians that are sick. And meanwhile, we've got $600 million in one agency that that we haven't been able to get our hands on. And the numbers I saw yesterday suggested that of the 60 to 80,000 Oregonians who pay their federal taxes but don't pay their state taxes, that we've only reached out to about 80% of those folks so far. So the $600 million that we have on the books doesn't include the people we haven't reached yet. So, Mr. Chairman, we can grind away at this a while. I know we want to talk about the tax gap, but I just wanted to finish up the conversation from yesterday before we moved into today.
I appreciate that. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the audit trail for a minute to understand a little bit more when you say the audits have been consistent. What does that mean? Does that mean the same management issues have come up, or what?
So, Co-Chair Manny, members of the committee, Representative Marsh, that is correct. So we have had the same three deficiencies, for material deficiencies, since 2011.
Senator? I'd like to hear from the director how you prioritize dealing with material deficiencies as unearthed in a Secretary of State audit. How, where's that come in your level of priorities? If this has been dragging on since three biennia, talk about it a little bit, would you please?
Sure. Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, I think it goes without saying that it has to be a pretty darned high priority. Now, whether it is the highest, whether it's the second highest, you know, I am also hearing that, you know, collection is a huge priority for the department. I'm hearing that our customer service efforts should be also a very high priority for the department. So I think what I have to do as a leader is to strategize to make all of them a priority, even though there can only technically be one. And it's very difficult. It's a difficult dance as a director to inherit a department that has so many responsibilities and reaches so many people and impacts so many people, and to find that priority to focus on singularly. I don't think you can. I mean, I don't think you can, but I think it has to be one. It has to be dealt with. We owe you a plan, and we owe you resolution, and that I will commit to you. I will go on to say that, you know, I've been very transparent about the conversation changing from where we've been to where we're headed. You know, we've had several years of conversations about Gentex, about anticipation, about what's to come. Well, we're here now. The rubber is meeting the road. And these conversations are hard to have, but I'm hearing them. So you need a plan, we'll get you a plan.
And one thing, too, I have been in conversation with the LFO staff in regards to the impact of the accounting manager position was reduced in the 2013-15 biennia. So we have been operating with a double-fill accounting manager off of our procurement manager position. Part of that has resulted in the lack of stability of that position. So in the last year and a half, we've had three individuals hold the accounting manager position. Part of it is that it's not a secure position. It's a double fill. It's not funded. So it could be that position could be abolished. We could say, you know, this is something that's not funded and we need to eliminate that position. And so that's created, again, some instability within the accounting team as well. And the turnover of having a new manager every few months has resulted in some insecurity within the accounting team that, you know, as I said, I've been talking to the LFO staff about how can we address that? How can we fix that issue?
Okay, so Since we've not gotten a chance to get into the presentation, and you're going to be back on Monday, but you're going to forward the documentation as requested by Senator Johnson. LFO, if you wouldn't mind making sure that all the committee members get the documentation too, so they can have time to review, and then we'll be able to come back with more questions and stuff. This is a very, very important conversation we're having here, and I think that Representative Gomberg said it, and Senator Johnson as well, is that you need to have the position filled that's going to help you achieve the goals that you have set out for you. So I from my perspective, I think that probably that critical position that you need in accounting and stuff, something that you probably don't want to wait on. You want to get moving on that pretty fast. Just my perspective. So I don't want to hold up. I know that we got a great presentation in a way, and I know that you'll be back. And again, you know, sometimes, you know, we can have something like, well, here's the ball right now, but here's a target date mm-hmm. for completion. Here are the outcomes, expectations, and here are the things that we're going to do. If you work a little closer with, make sure that you keep LFO in the loop. They can be a great resource for you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On with the show. Was that appropriate?
No. Okay, good afternoon. Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, my name is Derek Gasparini. I am currently the acting interim business division administrator at the Department of Revenue. You saw Eric Smith in this role during phase one presentations. I just wanted to point out that he is on rotation to another organization, and I've been asked to manage the business division in his absence during his initial rotation.
Ms. Gasparini?
Yes, sir.
Hold on, Senator.
I'm just curious, and maybe this is a question for the director, but generally rotations were to help develop a greater skill set in an employee. There's already turmoil. Why are rotations being approved? You've had as much turnover as has been evidenced by Ms. White. I don't know whether this happened on Director Ray's watch, or why would you rotate out a key person at a critical juncture for the agency?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, when making that decision, I took the enterprise as a whole under consideration as opposed to the department, admittedly. We work within an enterprise leadership structure in the executive branch, and one of the first tenets that was imposed on me was when there was an opportunity or a need that the enterprise has, that you should consider the greater good of the state. Now, given this...
Let me stop you, because I'm lost in DAS speak here. The enterprise, define that for a lay committee.
In lay terms, and I am not a DAS, I did not create it, but in lay speak, we operate as a unit, the executive branch agencies. We operate as a unit. And so when decisions are made, the decisions that are made as with the health of the entire system in mind, in addition to the health of your individual agency. And so when the opportunity was presented, and it was presented to me in a way that led me to believe that my sister agencies were in dire need of the assistance of my business director at the time, given the fact that we had someone that had the level of understanding and the level of competence that we have in Derek Gasparini, we determined that for a short period of time, we would be able to make that level of rotation.
Which agency was the receiving agency?
The DHS and OHA. It's for their modernization project of their system.
Well, nobody could argue that they could use the help. Thank you.
Sure.
I'll finish my introductory remarks.
Let me just say one other thing. Mr. Gasparini, this in no way reflects on your capabilities and your competence. to manage the division as the interim.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I understand the question.
Thank you.
Okay, so yes, I've been asked to serve as the business division administrator. I'm not new to the organization. I've been with the Department of Revenue for 13 years. I've served the last 8 years as our communications manager. Therefore, I have a very broad but shallow understanding of the organization's operations. I've spent the last month, yesterday marked 1 month of my interim appointment here. So I've been working with the business division's leadership teams to understand as much of the programs as possible. Before I worked as the communications section manager, I did work within the operations of the organizations. I was the program manager of the bankruptcy collection agency programs and warrants, liens, and garnishments. So I'd like to start by giving a very brief overview of the business division's structure, some of the programs the division administers. I'll then focus specifically on our compliance activities for general fund programs within the division. We do have a balance of both general fund and other fund programs within the division I administer. I'll share some of the measures we use to monitor program performance and tell you about some of the operational issues we've identified and our plans to address them. So the business division administers tax programs and services where the primary interaction is with business or commercial interests. The biennial budget for the division is approximately $38 million all funds, in round numbers about $20 million of general fund and $18 in other funds. You'll see on this slide that the business division is organized into three sections, the payroll and withholding section, the corporation and estate section, and the business special program section. Each area has some level of compliance work done within the section, but since other agency accounts is primarily a collections area, and will be talked more about in coming days during our collections presentations, and the special program sections is all funds, I'll cover mostly compliance from the perspective of corporation and payroll withholding. As you can see on the slide here, I have identified where vacancies occur within the division. There are a couple here and there, and as you can see, there's four within their other agency accounts area. There's a few here and there, some in collections. I will point out that we had two or three vacancies leading up to about November of 2016. We had planned those vacancies within the division because we were rolling out the payroll withholding section and the other agency accounts programs in the core systems replacement. So we had the opportunity to hire those folks. We held a couple positions vacant because we didn't want to train them and bring them onto the organization, train them in the old system, and then immediately have to turn around and train them in the new system as well. We were waiting to hire in December, and then we had the organizational decision to hold vacancies.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Certainly.
I understand the reasoning for not wanting to hire people on before, but the organization itself has a different type of culture. All organizations have their own culture. And to bring someone in early on and maybe kind of say, okay, well, I want you to work on it so you can get a better understanding of the organization, but this is now we're ready and this is what your primary mission. It would seem to me that would be an approach to kind of introduce people to the organization instead of just doing, I'm not saying that it would be just like Impact, come on in and this is what it is, you know, this is your job. But it would certainly eliminate some of these vacancies up there because you're bringing people on specifically for that. And I think that some of my colleagues would feel a little bit better knowing that the position that currently exists, they're there. We understand that you're integrating people into their proper position, but there are onboarding that's got to go on as well. So that's going to take time to get through. And there are certain other processes that you got to take your people through before you get them on board too. I could be completely off mark with this, but just a little, you know, I don't know. It's
Senator Manning, members of the committee, I do understand what you're saying, that there is more than just the training for a specific job duty when you're bringing someone in and onboarding them. In this particular case, it was just a matter of timing and having a lot of detailed work and heavy lifting into getting training materials ready to train for new system. And while we also have to train folks, we also have to have trainers to train folks. And the thought at the time was we were just focused on getting things prepared for instituting the new system, new processes, new procedures all the way around for the work. And at the time, we felt it was easier for just a few positions to do that this way this time. I appreciate and understand your comments, and we will consider that in the future.
Yep, Representative Gomper.
Mr. Gasparini, I'm just trying to make sure I understand your table here. If if we're looking at collecting corporate taxes, not withholding and not employment taxes, which of these bubbles is responsible for that area of pursuing delinquent accounts?
Certainly. Chair Manning, Representative Gomber, members of the committee. I think you might be reading ahead of my notes just a little bit, but I'd be happy to answer your question. The corporate tax is collected by the business tax collections unit within the payroll withholding section. So on the left-hand column, the third box down from the top, the business tax collections area, collects on multiple tax programs from within the business division.
The one that says account resolution?
The second one from the very top, the second one down in the light blue, the business tax collections that has 29.18.
The one with about a 25% vacancy rate.
The one that has experienced vacancies within the last handful of months. Yes, Representative Gumber. So going back to corporation and excise tax, the corporation section administers corporate excise and income taxes that are expected to bring in just over $1 billion for the current biennium, or approximately 6% of total general fund revenues. Over 30,000 C corporation returns are filed, but the largest 284 corporations account for approximately 62% of the total tax for that program. The corporate excise tax is imposed on those corporations that do business in Oregon, and the income tax is imposed on corporations that have income from an Oregon source. The corporation section also runs the state transfer tax, fiduciary and trust taxes, and transit district self-employment taxes. In that top box there, the policy systems estate unit, they have a group of analysts and auditors that work mostly on interpreting statute, writing and maintaining administrative rules, and preparing forms and information available to the public so that they can voluntarily comply. This is a small filing enforcement administrative support unit and three units of auditors. So auditors' primary concern for corporations is multi-state corporations that generate most of the revenue for the program. The complexity of laws and different treatment of income between states presents opportunities for companies to shift or hide income between their entities and among states. The section's compliance strategy set out areas identified as the highest potential for noncompliance and then outlines methods for audit activity to address those elevated risks of noncompliance. Each auditor in the corporation section generally conducts 8 to 10 audits per year. Each one takes between 6 and 18 months, depending on the complexity of the audit, complexity of the business, and the cooperation of the taxpayer.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Gasparini, you're reading your written testimony so fast that even those of us that are active listeners are getting a little bit lost.
Senator Manning, Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, I'm sorry. A little bit nervous, first time in front of this committee. I will take a deep breath and slow down. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you're on a roll, though.
While I'm trying to make up some time, I do want to make sure that I cover the material so you can understand it.
We have plenty of time. As a matter of fact, I got the gavel, so I can even push it back another day, too.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
With my colleague's approval.
All right, so I'll slow down just a moment and repeat that last paragraph because it's important. The section's compliance strategy sets out areas identified as the highest potential for noncompliance and then outlines methods for our audit activity to address those elevated areas of noncompliance.
Okay, so that obviously begs the question, so what are the elements? You say you've got criteria, and that's going to guide certain actions. Give a little more detail,
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, I don't want to outline all of the areas that we're looking for because I don't want to provide a roadmap for those to see exactly what we're looking for to be able to avoid us. But the types of things that we do look for in that compliance plan is reviewing that highest number of taxpayers that yield the largest amount of tax. So we know where the largest potential area for noncompliance, so that's where we focus some of those audits. We also look for sales factor apportionment issues. That seems to be where areas of noncompliance are for corporations that are filing here in Oregon. So we do take a look at what areas do we think are the highest area for not getting it right, and then look for audits in those areas to make sure that we maximize that presence in audit. I see that you're not quite...
I'm just sort of pondering. You've got high taxpayer returns.
Mm-hmm.
They've filed. They've paid a substantial tax, and you're looking for more versus a plethora of taxpayers on the other end that maybe are not such high tax compliant folks, and I'm just trying to figure out how do you weigh your compliant taxpayers who've written checks versus all of those who maybe not so much?
Senator Manning, Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, if I'm understanding your question, we do have a, that is not the only area that we look for in audit and corporations. We do have a balanced approach to try to capture multiple areas of noncompliance. Large corporations, multi-state corporations is one area that we look at. The personal income tax area that Joanne Martin spoke of yesterday, we also do have domestic C corporations looking at a larger number of companies in state.
Thank you. That rounds it out to okay. my satisfaction. Thank you.
Okay, so generally, auditors conduct 8 to 10 audits per year. They take a long time because of complex businesses. They have to travel out of state to visit the states where they're headquartered to make sure that there's better cooperation during the audit process. There is a number of audits in the corporation section because of the structure that are appealed, and appeals can take anywhere from 9 months to 6 years, depending on how far the department or the tax payer wants to appeal that. Okay, I did plan on touching very high level over multiple areas of compliance, so if you have any other questions about corporation, please. But I'll move quickly to payroll withholding section. So the way payroll and withholding section administers a withholding program as part of a multi-agency effort to administer combined payroll tax programs. The combined payroll tax programs have a far-reaching impact. They affect the payroll reporting of employers inside and outside of Oregon, as well as individual wage earners that file personal income tax returns. So the payroll withholding is basically someone works for an employer, they get paid, there's taxes withheld. That employer holds that tax in trust and remits it to the department, and that's where a large amount of revenue is generated through the withholding program, and then individual taxpayers get a W-2 at the end of the year, file their return, submit that W-2, and their personal income tax return may yield a refund, depending if that's if the withholding was more than the tax due. In addition to direct responsibility for the withholding program, the payroll withholding section also is under contract to administer Lane and TriMet payroll transit district taxes, and they also provide collection support to all of the programs in the business division. They work in partnership with multiple organizations through the combined payroll process. So they work with the Employment Department, with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Workers Benefit Board, Lane Transit District, the TriMet Transit District, Secretary of State for Registrations, Construction Contractors Board, and they work with other agencies through the Interagency Compliance Network to try to address multiple areas of compliance with misclassified workers and that kind of thing through audits. So just a quick overview of the payroll withholding section. Unit by unit, the program coordination unit provides legal, technical, educational, and assistance to direct the payroll tax programs throughout the section. The functions include processing appeals, coordinating with the AG's office, ensuring tax compliance for other agencies and programs. They're responsible for creating forms, publications, and the means to voluntarily file. As I said, the business tax collections units collect taxes for the business division. Collections will be covered more detail over the next couple days, so I was going to pass over that fairly quickly. The accounts resolution unit provides education and ensures new employers and the existing nearly 160,000 employers are complying with withholding taxes. They also work to resolve discrepancies on accounts. They do suspense for payments and returns that we'll get into a little bit more in a minute. They process returns and reconcile annual reports, as well as assist employers in correct reporting. There's a registrations unit that helps folks register their businesses, and then the business compliance and investigations unit that investigate employers that are not accurately reporting their payroll. They spend a significant amount of time in the field visiting job sites, talking with businesses, making sure that people are filing and reporting wages and classifying their workers appropriately, not misclassifying workers as independent contractors and paying them under the table. So their direct approach is trying to get at cash economy. And the Business Collections Investigations Unit has, in the last two calendar years, 15 and 16, conducted a little over 7,000 field investigations, visiting job sites and talking with folks. And again, they operate with the Interagency Compliance Network formed under House Bill 2815 in 2009. That just has multiple agencies working together to address folks in the field so that whether it's a business should have an easier time dealing with multiple agencies at once rather than getting approached by the Department of Revenue for payroll, employment for unemployment taxes, and DCBS.
Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And you may have already addressed this earlier. Within this division structure, where does a small business owner go or turn to if they have a question? They haven't received a letter, they haven't received the phone call, but they just have a question and they want to do things correctly. Is there somewhere within this structure or within another structure where a business owner can turn?
So a business owner can call our tax services area and get directed to this area. They can choose an option within our automated voice response system to get to business areas. But the business tax collections area, the accounts resolution area, and the registrations and support areas all have phone system call lines to be able to reach those folks.
Let me ask you this question. So if I had an entrepreneur, if I went and picked a client and said, I just want you to give them a call and test this. How's it going to work? Are they going to give you an A+?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Smith,
to get there?
I am not certain what the grade would be. I would not bet that it would be an A.
Okay. Let's think about that, because I think that's important to think about the proactive side of the Department of Revenue as much as having to always deal with the reactive side.
Absolutely, Senator Manning, or Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith. I do know within a month that the registrations area would be the place that they would probably best get their initial questions addressed. I am just not certain of the path for a caller to get there and understand how easy or how difficult it would be.
Can I ask one last question?
Go ahead, Co-Chair.
Talk about your relationship with our 19 small business development centers. These are folks around the state who are there to assist business development. Do you folks have a close relationship with them? Is it a relationship that could be enhanced?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I am not certain of the exact tenor of the relationship. I do know that we do engage with the small business centers because we do conduct multiple outreach events a year, and we man, I think, I'd have to look in my notes. I know it's over 100. I think it's about 180 outreach events per year that we try to attend throughout the state. Some are conducted through the small business center so that we can make sure and be available to employers new and existing.
Well, and I chair at the committee. I know you folks have done stuff in LeGrand where I have a relationship, but I just wonder if that's because I'm in this capacity, and I wonder what it is with the other 18 centers. We'll talk about that in the future.
Okay. Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so getting through the registrations and business compliance and investigations, I wanted to touch a little bit on metrics and then maybe take a quick example or two to show you what's going on, what we're responding to, and how we plan on working in the future. So I have a list here of just metrics that we use to measure our business. What's on this list isn't necessarily exceptionally important, just to confer an understanding of the types of things that we use to measure our business and what we're looking for to make sure that our processes are working appropriately. I do want to take a moment and illustrate where one of our programs recently implemented the new core system and where we are in the spectrum of adopting that new system, integrating that system into operations, and some of the work that we still have yet to do. So I know a couple of these look like eye charts. There's just a couple things that I'm hoping that these illustrate for you. So if you bear with me for just a moment. You'll see in the accounts receivable measure that there's a significant spike in December of 2016, shortly after we implemented the new system for our rollout 3 that went live in the end of 2016. Our previous filing enforcement process, and I'm just using this as illustration, but our previous filing enforcement process, including sending demand to file notices to employers that didn't file a subsequent quarter. So we have quarterly filings for payroll and withholding. If someone files one quarter, says they have employees, they're required to file a return the subsequent quarter. If they don't file a return the subsequent quarter, we send them a notice saying, hey, we believe you're subject to this tax. Please file a return. if they don't file in response to that notice, we had four filing enforcement staff that would manually review accounts and look and set up assessments based on the information that we had. So the remainder of our process in following up in collections, in having people available to direct phone calls, was based on 3,000 to 4,000 assessments per quarter. When we implemented the system, we have automated portions of our process that we had not previously automated. So you can see just from the spike in accounts receivable that we now send 16,000 assessments in response to those 16,000 demands. And so it generates more calls, it generates more work for us, and we're still figuring out how to address calls, how to address further automation in the system to flatten out the process overall. So then on the bottom, you can see the automated call distributor statistics where we have minimal wait times and responses. And then at that peak where we have automated processes to drive more work, we have more calls. We're responding to those.
So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
How does that compare with other states? How does that compare with industry averages? Are we doing good? I mean, part of me says, gosh, you're waiting 7 minutes to get on an average call length, and 1 in 5 of the calls are being abandoned. To me, that's a little bit challenging, but maybe there's something behind it I don't understand.
Coacher Manning, Coacher Smith, what I was hoping to illustrate here is that we know and understand that we are driving a higher number of calls because of the automated activity that we are now generating that we didn't before. And so that's kind of the canary.
I don't understand what that means.
Okay, so for me, that's kind of the canary in the coal mine that says we've got a problem with the process if we're driving call wait times up, if we're not able to respond to the calls that we have, if we're automating a process and we don't have the rest of the downstream process automated or figured out, we have a problem because it's affecting taxpayers, it's affecting our ability to respond to them.
So I appreciate the candidness. So what we're going to need to see on that is what the plan is to address that issue.
Absolutely. And so Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I was wanting to use this as illustration to show that we know what we need to do in response. We have solution requests in for our technical team to address part of the automation to make sure that we flatten that process out. But it's kind of a process of we're changing processes fundamentally from where they were in our legacy system into our new system. It is trying to show a little transparency in the fact that we're in the midst of squashing a bubble down and another bubble pops up.
So did the new, can I follow up, Mr. Chair? So if we would have asked you this question 6 years ago, 4 years ago, we didn't have these issues. Is the new system causing this?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I wouldn't say that the new system is causing this. I think that the system is providing us opportunities to do things that we haven't done before and to do them at a volume that we haven't done them before.
Volume we haven't done them before.
So like the failure to file assessment, we're actually assessing and reaching more people than we had previously,
right,
which is driving calls, which is driving further processes down the line. So we are still in the process of figuring out how to respond to all of the downstream impacts of the business process changes.
Got it. Okay. That's very logical to me. Okay.
So essentially, that's what I was trying to illustrate here, is that we're automating processes. We have measurements that show us kind of where it might be showing unintended consequences, so we can respond to that. We can address system changes, process changes, whatever it is that we need to do to flatten this out so we can accomplish our work and not drive the need for more taxpayer response. I mean, we want to be available to folks, but we don't want to drive volumes to a point that we can't respond appropriately. Okay, so this is just further illustration of my preceding point. And
can I go back to your preceding point?
Certainly.
You said that you don't want to drive calls that you can't service. And yet the people that are calling are your potential taxpayers, and exactly what we need in terms of tax compliance and revenue. And so I'm just wondering, as you look across the agency, what are the opportunities that you could, even for a short period of time, redress that with a request for additional people? And I guess I'm going back to the director's comments that across the enterprise, when an agency is experiencing some degree of difficulty, would it not make sense to have the enterprise reach out and assist DOR? You are our key revenue driver right now, and we're about to, if some of these policy bills pass, make you more of that key driver. And I'm just curious whether or not you're in, this is a question for the director, not you, whether or not you're internally organized in such a way as to deal with the agency management deficiencies, drive revenue, help Oregonians, and I'm just trying to figure out where do you start making requests that say we're a pretty damn important agency to the state and we're drowning.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I have not reached the level where I believe as a leader we're drowning. I think that we are becoming aware of many, many more responsibilities that the legislative branch and the executive expects of us. And in real time, we are being asked to address our management and staffing needs. And so this is a growing operation for us. I don't think that we are drowning. However, I do agree that we need a more specific plan to address all of the obligations that are coming in our direction. And I alluded to that yesterday. There are initiatives coming fast and furiously at the department, and we have to figure out how to deal with that. With respect to the enterprise, we have not reached across to other sister agencies for assistance. That's largely because we still believe that we can manage whatever it is that we're requested to do with the assistance of staff and resources. We just have to create a greater plan for those resources.
Have you, as the director of one of the state's arguably most important agencies, had a conversation with the governor or staff about what of this plethora of new initiatives are being sent your way, and ask for their assistance in maybe postponing some of those? Some of these new initiatives will be bills that will pass both the House and the Senate and will go to the governor for signature. And I'm just wondering whether or not you've had a thoughtful conversation with respect to your new management philosophy and trying to redress some of the issues in the agency, to ask to maybe postpone some of this stuff and get your house sort of right-sized, get your vacancies filled, begin to take those $3 million investments that drive $36 million in return and get those to the top of the pile rather than all this other stuff that the legislature thinks up that might be a good idea for you to do.
Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we have had conversations with many individuals, including members of the governor's staff, about all of the obligations, particularly some of the new obligations that are being proposed. And I have not proposed or suggested or requested any postponement, but I have been candid with everyone that asks that, you know, these obligations will require resources, whatever they are, even if it's a reprioritization of resources. And so those are the types of conversations that are being had right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Co-chair, members of the committee, just to continue here, what I was hoping to illustrate is that we're in the shakedown period of implementing this new system, and just to provide a little transparency for what we're dealing with on a couple things, and that we're really integrating new processes, new tools, and we're still fine-tuning. We are 80 to 90% of the way there. I was just wanting to show a little bit of some of the things we're dealing with in getting us the rest of the 10% of the way. So some of my slides were further illustration of that point. So I wanted to get to our challenges and mitigation. So really one of our biggest things that we're dealing with in operations right now is proficiency in using the system. how to understand and refine our business processes, and then how we either need to change the system or change our procedures so that it works as best as possible. Continue training staff, not just in the system, but all the way around in how we accomplish our work. Identify new areas of work based on that automation, and really how to shift staff and address workload changes as we work through all of the continuing automation, all of the continued opportunities that the program provides us. A couple other things that we are looking at right now is the potential of losing expertise in corporation programs. It is very complex. It is very dense tax policy, and it takes a long time for folks to get up to speed. So when we have potential losses in that area, it takes extended time for training, it takes extended time for that. So when we lose expertise, it does impact our ability to produce new assessments that we can collect upon.
Senator Johnson?
Do you have any kind of a bench building philosophy, or you just wait for somebody to say, I'm out of here, to go take a better job or whatever, retire? Are you actively pursuing strategies to work with universities, to work with others to get a pipeline of potential recruits to public service?
So, Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, in our mitigation strategies, we do have ways that we hope to recruit and train auditors. I know that we have in the past. I really don't know if we have current plans for universities, intern programs, that kind of thing. I understand the suggestions.
Having sat here for the last 2 days, the recurring theme is staff, either not properly trained, not properly paid, so because you're double filling positions and you're working out of class. And so it seems to me that maybe some kind of a systemic review of use of staff, internal morale, external factors that are, wage differentials. Until you get your staff issues taken care of, it seems to me that you're not going to have a fighting chance to get some of the rest of this stuff taken care of. High turnover. Lack of proper knowledge skills. I mean, those have been appearing in audits for 6 years. And now comes the question of what are you going to do about it? Because every single point on that slide is staff. Every one of them has a staff component in it.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, you're absolutely right. People are our most important resource, but the illustration of this is not that there is no existing plans for addressing that. It is a significant operational concern, and that's why I was just trying to address it here and show some of the mitigations that we're using as far as developing cross-training and trying to develop folks for potential losses. Now, we're not experiencing those losses today, but we are thinking about it now and trying to plan for the time to make sure that we do have some consistency and knowledge.
Well, respectfully, it's not just losses, people walking out the door. You've got a boatload of vacancies. And recruitment seems to be as important a mitigation factor as cross-training. Just a thought.
So, duly noted. Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Since we're on the staff topic, have there been any internal employee surveys completed? And if so, could we get copies of those?
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, we do. Actually, we just released the most recent employee engagement survey either today or yesterday. We will have those results for you in the very near future, but we do a quarterly employee engagement survey of all of our staff, and that employee engagement survey may have an impact on our KPMs. I'm not sure, but it is something that we track.
Is that something we could get over the last, and I know it's a lot of paperwork, over the last couple of years, so we could see the trend in those surveys?
Co-chairs,
and I realize some of them are prior to you, but I think it'd be insightful for us to see what the folks internally have to say.
Sure, and I'm not sure how far back they go, but I will try to get you the most recent, let's say 4 years. Is that?
Oh, I don't need 4 years.
Okay.
Let's just go the last.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, we started in 2014 in a yearly employee engagement survey. We can provide the surveys that we've done. Our current one for 2017 is open now. It won't close for another week.
Okay.
We can provide you those results when those results are tabulated, but we can certainly provide you the most couple years, most recent employee engagement survey since we started doing them in 2014.
Awesome. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Then unless I misunderstood you, Director Ray, you said something was going to be released today or yesterday?
The employee engagement survey, we release it to all of it's open for all of our staff.
Oh,
to
you
take.
Released it to the staff
yes,
to participate, and you'll get this.
And
okay.
We'll get the result. Yes.
Thank you. I just didn't understand.
I was not clear. I apologize.
Okay, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, that comes really close to the end of my presentation, just in talking about the challenges and mitigations. I'm open for any questions that you still have for my portion. I see we're at 4:15. I'm looking to co-chair and staff for where we go from here. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? No further questions. We reserve the right to call you back at a later date. That's where they tell me. So thank you. Great presentation. So we're going to continue on, and the next one up in the on-deck circle, speaking baseball metaphors. Okay, Mr. John Hart, research tax gap. Let's talk about gaps in taxes.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm John Hart, an economist in our research section. And I am here to talk about what I like to call compliance, but what everyone else likes to call the tax gap. The my bailiwick is in the theoretical in compliance and how we estimate the tax gap. And so if you have operational questions, I'll probably demur on those. One of the questions that Representative Gomberg had yesterday was about how non-filers are reflected in the tax gap. And that gets into a pretty complex topic about how the accounts receivable and the tax gap interact. So I can talk a little bit about that before I start with the definitions on this first page. The tax gap is the difference between the taxes owed and the taxes paid for a tax year. And so for the personal income tax, tax year 2014 reflects the taxes owed for economic activity that occurred during the calendar year of 2014. The accounts receivable is a small portion of the tax gap, or contains a small portion of the tax gap that we identify. So non-filers that we identify, the tax portion of how much of the bill we send them is reflected in the tax gap. But there's multiple years of that in the accounts receivable. So we have tax year 2014, tax year 2013, non-filers reflected in our accounts receivable. The penalty and interest portion of those bills is not part of the tax gap because it's just looking at tax. So like I said, that's fairly complicated stuff. It's worth noting that the tax gap is a very large number. I think I'm going to say the number 1.3 billion later. Our accounts receivable is, if we include corporate withholding and personal tax right now, the accounts receivable showing up on our financial statements is around $1 billion. Those numbers are close by pure coincidence. So there's a small portion that we identify every year, the tax gap, that goes into the uncollected part of the accounts receivable. Those parts that we identify and collect are not in the accounts receivable.
Excuse one, you just said something that kind of drew my attention. I'm not clear on that. Do that again, please.
Okay. I'll try to do it in a more straightforward way, Co-Chair Manning. The tax gap is the difference between the tax owed and the tax paid for a calendar year for personal income tax. The accounts receivable reflects multiple years of tax penalty and interest liability that we have identified and sent bills for. So the accounts receivable will have I think we have something in our accounts receivable now from the 1970s, for instance. But we also add a couple hundred million dollars and collect a couple hundred million dollars from that accounts receivable every year. When I talk about the accounts receivable also, I'm using a broader measure than what's in the Legislative Fiscal Office's report on liquidated and delinquent accounts. So that includes on April 17th, if someone's filed a return and we know they owe money, that's what I think of as accounts receivable. It wouldn't be liquidated and delinquent at that point.
Representative Gomberg first.
Mr. Hart, let me try and repeat that back to you and tell me if I'm on track here. The annual tax gap, the annual amount of money that's the difference between what we collect and what we think is owed, is comprised of three things. The people who send in their tax returns but don't send us any money, the people who don't send us tax returns, and the people who send us tax returns but lie about how much they owe us by getting money paid under the table or cash or just simply fabricating their returns. That's the annual amount that we call the gap, which is completely different than our accounts receivable, which is made up of money that people report they owe to us going back several years until we just finally quit trying to collect it. Did I say that right?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, the only thing I would take issue with is the people lying to us. We do have three components of the tax cap: non-filing, non-paying, and misreporting. I think that I personally believe most of the misreporting is unintentional.
So you don't think there's much fraud out there?
There's plenty of fraud, okay. But most of the tax gap, I believe, is unintentional. So as we get into that, the tax gap is related to the visibility of income. So we have a much smaller tax gap coming from wages, where we have third-party reporting and withholding. We have a smaller part coming from interest and dividends, where we have third-party reporting but not necessarily withholding. But we have a large part of the tax gap from those areas that are less visible and complex. So for personal income tax, most of the tax gap is coming from small business.
Representative Gomberg has been a pathfinder in helping many of us to understand that in agency land, there has been a prevalence of just dispatching uncollectible debt in multiple hundreds of millions of dollar amounts. You just mentioned an account that would go back to the 70s. Is that in litigation? Is that why, with this preference for agencies to just make uncollectible debt go away, why are you tracking somebody from the 70s?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I don't know about any particular case. I know that we've seen things into the 70s. We have very concrete rules about what we can write off, and our write-offs are actually relatively small.
What's relatively small in DOR land?
$10 million.
Okay.
Excuse me. $15.8 million.
And who in DOR is responsible for making that call?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, our collection section has had several projects that they've called Save Our Accounts Receivable, or SOAR, where they have gone through and done kind of in large batches write-offs, and they make calls on whether they think it's collectible. If there's a wage source they can identify, or if we have received payments, then it won't be written off.
Let me, one more follow-up, and this is to the director. Do you see those, or do people in the bowels of your organization make that determination absent directorial input or agreement?
Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, it does not reach my level.
Okay, I'd like to flag that as part of Representative Gonberg's ongoing issue with uncollectible debt. I think that there is mounting interest in the legislative branch to know the name of the person or persons who actually are responsible for deleting debt. And I think that there is, with Representative Gomberg's leadership, growing interest in the legislature knowing what are the objective criteria across agencies. That one agency may have a tolerance to soar their accounts receivable more or less so than others.
And we will, thank you, Senator, we will get more into that when we go into collections, and we can really probe into that. Right now, Co-Chair Smith has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and the timing of my question probably should wait, but let me get it on the record really quick. And I should know this, but I don't. How is the collection or the write-off policy, excuse me, the write-off policy set? Is that by rule? Is it by someone just making a professional judgment? Is it by statute?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, we have a statute, but I think our collections manager can get into that more.
Can you have them prepared?
Yeah.
Have her or him prepared to share with us how, and maybe even give us reference ahead of time of what that ORS is so we can read it? Because I mean, if the fault's on us, then we need to know that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so in the interest of brevity, most of this presentation is actually based on a 2014 paper that's linked at the back of these slides, compliance with Oregon's personal and corporate tax programs. If you want a lot of detail on the estimate of the gap and reasons for noncompliance, it's in there. I'm gonna move forward with this and hopefully be able to finish in the allotted 4 minutes, if that suits the committee. The points that I'm trying to make in setting this up are really cautions about using the tax gap in thinking that the full amount is collectible. If we could see it, if there was data available to help us reduce it, we would use that data and it would already be reduced. So the reason the gap exists is because it's unknown to the department and in a lot of cases unknown to the taxpayer. Comparisons to other states and to the IRS aren't very useful because most of the gap is coming from business income. So for instance, a state that has more business income than another is going to have a larger tax gap just because there's more complexity and opportunity in the income sources for that state. In a lot of cases, only the taxpayer can know their true liability, and the department doesn't have a lot of information for that. And the complexity makes it hard for the taxpayer as well. This slide shows the misreporting percentage by types of income. For wage income, the tiny little bar on the left, there's about a 1% average misreporting percent. For proprietor income, for farm income, the average misreporting percent is about 63%. So that means if there's $100 of income out there, we expect about $37 to be reported on returns.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I want to dig in on this a little bit, and maybe this is more for the Revenue Committee. It's more for the Revenue Committee. It really concerns me when we've got all these folks out there that are trying to accurately report their income and others are not to... Let me hold back my question. It's for the Revenue Committee, and so I'll address that issue there. Sorry for the interruption, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm going to continue the interruption here. I just wanted to clarify. It says 63% on the big bar was misreported, but did you just say underreported?
That's the net misreporting percent. So of the true tax liability or of the true income, that's the amount that is misreported. So
that is not reported?
If there's $100 in true income, that means that we'd expect to see $37. And so that's a mix of both the income and the deductions. You can have overstated deductions that reduce the net income. And so because there's kind of two components to those business incomes, overstating deductions or understating income can lead to that.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, this is where I've got to weigh in, because on the deduction side, that's up for, sometimes can be up for interpretation. You know, what's considered advertising? Okay. But on the income side, if you generate that income either through your business activity or the sale of an asset or through interest earnings, to me, it seems like that's pretty cut and dry on the income you ought to be reporting. What am I missing on that? How do we get into gray area?
Co-Chair Smith. There is some gray area something like capital gains, for instance. You might have an inheritance discounted for the liquidity of the asset, for instance. So there's some of that, but there's also because it's actually much harder to audit income than it is to audit deductions, and so in that case it may be a case that the opportunity is there for misstatement.
Yeah. Is that because someone's hiding cash?
Okay. Yeah.
Co-Chair Smith, cash is definitely a part of that. It's when there's no paper trail, when there's no checks or credit card statements, it is much harder to find.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the sake and respect of time and stuff, what I'd like to do is, Mr. Hart, if you don't mind, we can bring you back tomorrow so you can finish this up. Because it's really interesting, and there are a few more questions that I don't want to rush this and give you an opportunity to help us better understand so that we know what we need to do in order to help you to move ahead. And I think that for the sake of the committee here, LFO, what do we look like, moving forward?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Hart can finish the tax gap discussion tomorrow. We'll have an hour and a half tomorrow, regular subcommittee meeting for the next 2 days. Then the audit and fraud detection folks will be here, Ms. Lawley and Ken Ross, and then that will be a nice flow into the collections that is on schedule, that was regularly scheduled for the next 2 days. So the schedule will hold, Mr. Co-Chair. So,
Representative Gombert.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With apologies, I'll be a few minutes late tomorrow. I've got three different bills that are up for hearing on the Senate, so I'll be here as quick as I can. Just very briefly to touch on something that we left kind of dangling. The co-chair had asked about write-offs, and that is defined in statute and reviewed by the Attorney General, but is applied, of course, by each agency as we go. And the total across all state agencies for write-offs annually is about $100 million. But I'm also interested in the case of the Department of Revenue. We indicated that there's about $16 million in write-offs. I'd like to hear, when we reconvene, about a different category, and that is adjustments, where they list $150 million of adjustments in delinquent debt, which I take to mean that we negotiated down in one form or another the amount that was due to us. So I'd be interested in hearing about that number, which is 10 times larger than their write-offs, but still at the end of the day means fewer dollars in the general fund.
So would that be something that would fall under the area of collections?
The department has prepared, has a nice presentation on these two particular items.
Okay. Colleagues, tomorrow, so that if you're in session, appreciate we get here, so we can kick it off, and then you can come back in at your leisure in order to move ahead on this. But I do want to appreciate everybody's participation, and very informative. We're trying to find out how we can help. So I think with that being said, we're going to adjourn and reconvene tomorrow, 1500, 3 o'clock for civilians. We are adjourned.